Mozart wrote in a rhythm, and people will play Mozart every year and not feel the need to change it up a little. If you've got bum, 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 people today want to go bum, ba-da-dum, bum, 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 you know, and Mozart wrote something that's worth playing. Play that. Work on that. And the musician gets to recreate it. Not repeat it, but recreate it. And I think that's such a great challenge for us working on these pieces, is to really take what's there. It's good music. Let's try playing that before we bring it into our own jazzy self-interpretation.
Hi, and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Jim Elliott.
And I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And today on the program, we have Jeffrey Hawkins.
Hello.
Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm a fan already. I was just re-listening to the Clowns and Fools episode.
Nah.
Smart guys, talented guys. And so.
Yeah, they were fun to have in the studio. I was worried that they were going to, you know, fight each other.
The great clown fool brawl.
That's a nice shout out to Ken Schatz and Blake Hackler.
This is great. Well, you guys are great too.
Thank you.
You went to the Delaware Conservatory, the professional actor training program at Delaware.
Yeah, the PTTP, as they call it, the Professional Theater Training Program at University of Delaware. And that in itself is a unique program for a few reasons, but one is that they train almost exclusively, not only in stage, but classical stage. If you want to be a leading actor in a regional classic company, it's a good start.
What was your first step after graduation?
Well, you know, it's funny. In a way, it was the reverse. I had been doing classical theater most of my career. My first show, actually directed by a PTTP graduate, I did The Merry Wives of Windsor. I played Jack Rugby. And I was there, and I was impressed with those graduates. And they looked good, they sounded good, and I thought they were onto something. And so fast forward years later, there's Bart Scheer. I'm doing a production of Titus Andronicus with him, and he mentions that. And I spent the first year there wishing I was anywhere else. But by the end of the first year, man, I was on board, and it kind of clicked over, you know, and I thought, I'm glad I'm not anywhere else. And like so many things in life, when you finally say, you know what, I'm here, I'm not anywhere else, I've chosen to be here, let's do this, and then it all clicked.
So what was your first step out of grad school?
Ironically, I left grad school a couple months early to go do a Midsummer Night's Dream at a Great Lakes Theater Festival, another company I've been with for a long time.
You do work with a lot of companies.
I do.
For whole seasons.
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky to be around companies. My first professional show was with the former Arizona Shakespeare Festival. And these were guys that worked together all the time. And it was great to be a young guy in a company, a real company, and watch the old guys, listen to the old guys. Now remember, this is before cell phones. So when you were in the rehearsal room, you were watching, you were listening, you were learning. And I loved it. I loved watching the guys go through Winter's Tale and go through Henry V and Romeo and Juliet and to listen. How do the old guys do it? How does the guy play Lord Capulet? You know, and it was great. There's something to it. Just watching, learning, listening from the old guys.
That's one of the core reasons we started The State of Shakespeare, which is acting as a craft. And like any craft, you can learn from the craftsmen who come before you.
Absolutely.
Just to get you, this older, experienced Shakespeare actor who's got worlds of knowledge under his belt.
Maybe small satellites.
Pass it on to the younger generation.
What do you think is the future direction of Shakespeare on stage?
Shakespeare on stage, wow. I think that people will always be attracted to these stories. I hope people will always be attracted to these stories. I hope young actors will always be attracted to this material. You know, I'm afraid that it may not be very sexy to a lot of actors. I hope the future is bright. I'm by no means a kind of museum piece actor when it comes to these plays. I don't want pumpkin pants and tights all the time. In fact, I almost never want pumpkin pants and tights. But, you know,
I'm kidding. I gotta tell you.
We're going to have to save this interview for Halloween.
In decades of doing Shakespeare and watching Shakespeare, I've never heard that phrase. I'll never forget it.
Well, I've seen too much of it. I haven't been in much, thankfully, but I like a good, slick, stylized Shakespeare. I like sunglasses and sharp suits on stage. I've got no problem with that stuff, so long as the language itself is still strong and poetic. You know, this stuff is out, it's strong, it's beautiful, it's bigger than life, you could say, and it tends to be unapologetic in its beauty and its strength. I don't know. So I hope that the future is bright and that people will still come to see these plays. But I think that also requires strong actors. I think it requires people that can deliver. It's one thing to get what you're saying. But the key, as always, you know, is to have the audience get what you're saying. It's one thing for you to feel it. We need the audience to get to feel it.
We're talking with Jeffrey Hawkins, classically trained actor and professional Shakespearean
actor.
You've worked all over the country in some of the theaters that are producing the best work anywhere in the country and anywhere in the world. The Guthrie, Great Lakes. I'm curious, where haven't you worked that you would like to work? Who's doing great work that you admire and would like to emulate?
I'd love to see Alabama Shakes. I've never been down there. I've seen Ashland, and they do nice stuff. And so I want to work at places that value the words and don't undercut it with overly conceptualized work or underplay it with a kind of quote-unquote truthiness or realism. You know, I mean, is Picasso real? You know, that doesn't really look like a lady with a water jar. You know what I mean? And Seurat wasn't real when he was doing Sunday Afternoon on La Grande Jatte, you know? Mm. But if you step back and look at it, the effect of his very deliberate, very technical work is just a shimmering beauty. And I'm interested in that kind of stuff. People that really want to work. I'm interested in people that want to paint dots. Mm. I like to deliberately create beauty.
Well, that brings me to a question that we do want to ask you, which is, given that you like to paint the dots, when you get a new role, what's your first step in approaching the text?
Well, you know, read the play. And it's just the kind of basic scansion, you know? How long is it? Is this regular?
When you're doing that, I mean, I want to hear more about you do, but when you're doing scansion, what do you look for?
Well, I'm counting it out, and I'm looking for, is the meter running long? Is it running consistently long? Do we have a lot of feminine endings? Are we suddenly in a lot of trochaic feet at the top of every verse line? And just start to ask questions.
And those lead you to performance choices?
Yeah, well, certainly rhythm choices. I try very hard early on to really keep the rhythm. You know, there's always some good old-fashioned debate about this stuff. I used to be a real punctuation guy, but the thing that I found, anyway, is that, you know, every edition's got different punctuation. So I'm kind of going back to what we know, just the verse lines, and run with that. Kind of really force that into your body early on, and let me find the way to what I think Shakespeare's got. That's kind of where I start, because I think it's interesting. When you see what looks like on the page, a full stop in the middle of a verse line, I go, well, maybe that was put there by someone other than the man himself. So let's try and run it to the end. How does that work? That's certainly where I start.
You've brought a remarkable piece of verse with you today from Two Gentlemen of Verona. Can you tell us a little bit about the piece that you've selected?
So here we are. You know, we started to play. Proteus is head over heels in love with Julia. And then he goes to join his buddy, Valentine, in Milan. And no sooner does he get there, but Valentine, who had sworn off women and who kind of chided Proteus for so long about being head over heels, is now himself head over heels. And it seems to kind of ruffle the feathers between the two old friends that suddenly Valentine is himself in love and maybe doesn't have as much time for Proteus as he used to. And now Proteus is away from his own love, looking at two other people in love. But above and beyond that, Proteus is now seemingly turned head over heels now for Valentine's newest, Sylvia.
This theme of men resisting love, of the gullible falling into love, of men chiding them for doing so, is a very common theme in Shakespeare.
Yeah, we see that a lot, don't we? Yeah.
We certainly see it in Much Ado.
Yes, yes. Romeo, Benvolio.
Love's Labor's Lost.
Yes, yes.
We're talking with Jeffrey Hawkins, and he is here to perform Act 2, Scene 4 from The Two Gentlemen of Verona, the character of Proteus. Jeffrey, would you mind giving it a shot?
Sure, let's give it a whirl. Even as one heat, another heat expels, or as one nail by strength drives out another, so the remembrance of my former love is by a newer object quite forgotten. Is it mine eye, or Valentina's praise, her true perfection, or my false transgression that makes me reasonless to reason thus? She is fair, and so is Julia that I love, that I did love, for now my love is thawed, which, like a waxen image against a fire, bears no impression of the thing it was. Methinks my zeal towards Valentine is cold, and that I love him not as I was wont. Oh, but I love his lady too, too much. And that's the reason I love him so little. How? Shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus, without advice, begin to love her? 'Tis but her picture I've yet beheld, and that hath dazzled my reason's light. But when I look on her perfections, there is no reason, but I shall be blind. If I can check my erring love, I will. If not, to compass her, I'll use my skill.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was really lovely.
Ah, thanks, thanks, thanks.
Lots of things happening technically in this speech. First, the quality of your voice delights me because I can hear you really playing those long, continuant consonants, especially at the ends of lines, those L's and the V's. You imbue them with a lusciousness, which I think is often overlooked. Where does that come from in your training?
Boy, I don't know. It might come from early in the morning right now. I don't know. God, that's such a nice compliment to hear. I'm always so terribly critical of my own voice. I've always thought it was one of the weakest parts of my instrument. So that's nice to hear. Thanks.
Does any of your observations, you know, working in the rep companies, you talked about listening to other older actors, do you think that had any influence?
Well, maybe it affected my appetites, you know, that I could see people doing big things in a very beautiful way, or kind of unabashedly poetic, and still be very honest.
We started talking about your process, how you start your process. You start with scansion, or reading the play, scansion.
Sure.
Do you pay attention to the sounds of the words in any way?
In a kind of onomatopoeia type way?
Or just in terms of, you know, what he was saying, the continuates or the fricatives. I mean, do they pop for you? Or?
Sure, sure. Those things do mean something to me. I think that probably meant a lot to the playwright. I remember one of the first early kind of conservatory type classes I had, an old mentor of mine, Randy Messersmith, he had a class where he just handed out the names of certain Shakespeare characters, and this is a bunch of 16-year-olds in a class, you know, and the name I got was Lord Scroope, and so you had to kind of say that name 5 times, Lord Scroope, Lord Scroope, and there's something to that that gives you an idea of who that guy was. Shakespeare is kind of genius with that name, because what it does and how you hear it and what Scroope does to the king is really, really fascinating.
He's not a good guy.
He's not a good guy. Not a good guy. He kind of scroops him over. But yeah, I think that Shakespeare was certainly giving his acting company all the direction in the words.
Rhetorically, a lot of antithesis at work here.
Sure.
Any of them pop into mind? I hear you working them.
Yeah, hopefully not too hard. But yeah, there's a lot of this and that. There's a lot of, well, so I guess we're looking at Julia and Sylvia, really, then and now. Melon and Verona.
Proteus and Valentine.
Proteus and Valentine, certainly.
So how do you take that rhetorical clue that is there in the text and turn that into something actable on stage?
Well, it can be a little maddening. When every word is good, the challenge then becomes deletion. What can you give more value to? That's another thing that I always struggle with, because I tend to want to drag it all with me. And of course, we know if everything's important, then nothing's important. And so I like to kind of try to chisel away at it, you know what I mean? Kind of leave some things behind. You try to go for those antithetical words that pop out. You know, something that just makes it easier on the ears of the audience, you know, because it's enough for me to walk on stage and know what I'm saying and know what I'm feeling. But like I said, you know, got to get them to get it. And there's the rub.
Yeah. And do you have any thoughts on how you go about doing that?
Well, I will say this. One of those kind of no-nos you hear all the time about indication, I have zero problem with that.
What do you mean by indication?
Well, I mean, you know, if I say, if for instance, the simplest thing of all, if I'm downstage and they just left upstage, I may refer to them. Anything that kind of helps today's ears get the story. I've got zero problem with that.
Right, helping the audience visually as well as vocally.
Yeah, that's not to say I'm doing a juggling act and I'm sawing the air too much, but right. I have no problem throwing that stuff up in the air. You know, even as one heat, another heat expels. On the other hand, Or is one nail by strength drives out another, you know, to try to, I'm not saying I'm going to imitate or mime a hammer and nail, but like, just so the guy in the third row goes, oh, I get that.
Right. I have a question about line 206, which is...
And that hath dazzled my reason's light.
Hmm.
Now, when the line scans, there's an archaism there. That word dazzled might be broken up into three syllables.
You're right.
In order to make the line scan,
you're right.
The verse scan. Eliding those three syllables into two requires that a pause show up somewhere in the line. I'm wondering, what do you do about those archaisms? Do you,
you know,
do you help the audience understand at the expense of the meter, or what kind of a choice do you like to make as an actor?
Normally, I do like dazzled. I like elongating that. I like those things, and I think there's clues in that stuff. Why I did it here, I think that may just be an old choice, to be honest with you. An old director wanted, to do dazzled. But I will say, I tend to like those. Another one is, you could argue, in as one heat, another heat expels. In this case, I kind of like even as. I like the, what's that, a dactylic foot there. There's something about da-da-da-dum. Bum, bum. There's something about that that is kind of...
Gets you off to a running start.
Yeah, kind of juicy. Yeah, it gets you off to a running start. I think that's interesting. I think that's interesting. So I do tend to prefer those, although I just ignored that one in line 206.
It's interesting, I think that...
Welcome to the state of Shakespeare.
I think it's interesting that we find that the meter must be paid. Once it's established, it must be paid no matter what. So if you're speaking that line and you choose to make it two syllables, and that hath dazzled my reason's light, there has to be a pause. The meter requires a pause after dazzled. And if you turn it into three, the meter still must be paid by continuing that line. And that hath dazzled my reason's light. Takes out that pause. So in a way, that word dazzled, it's imperative that it be punched by either by causing a pause after it or by lengthening it through three archaic syllables and using all of the beauty of all of the sounds of all of the words all of the time.
What a tricky little line that is. And that hath dazzled my reason's light.
And I think it speaks to the through line of this speech, which is, I've lost my ability to think.
Yeah.
And he uses reason or form of reason at least five times in the speech and in multiple different definitions.
Right, right.
And what has it that's upset his reason? It's something he's seen.
Yeah.
Not anything that he feels for this woman other than his the impression that his eyes give him for her.
Yeah, and I think he tries to catch himself on that. It's like, 'tis but her picture I've yet beheld. You know, it's like, I think there's something about, at least the way that I was taking is that... Okay, stop. You don't even know her. You just met her. Get over it. But on the other hand, she's so beautiful, I can't help it. And the bottom line at the end of the speech with that rhyming couplet, you know, okay, if I can check myself here, I will. We're good. On the other hand, if I can't, she's mine. I think that's very interesting. And I had a Shakespeare director, a friend of mine, who said something. I don't know if he's quoting or not, but I think it's a great thing. That in Shakespeare, every scene ends with a promise. And I love that.
I love that too.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
What do you think he decides?
Well, I think he decides to table it for the moment. The next time we see Proteus, if I'm correct in saying this, is another soliloquy.
Yeah, it's to leave my Julia, shall I be forsworn?
Here we
Act 2, scene 6.
And now he's still hammering it out.
Yeah, and
I can't do this. Can
words.
I do this? Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if you can help me understand some of these lines, which are a real puzzle.
Oh, man, let's see.
I believe you fit these lines. In particular, I'm looking at line 203 and 204. How shall I dote?
Yeah.
What on earth does this mean? Would you read the line for us?
Yeah, I will. And I'll tell you, what I'm doing with it currently is a different take than I've either heard or done before. And I'm interested in pursuing it. That's why I did it here. This is how I'm taking this line today. How shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus without advice begin to love her? And the reason that came up is because audiences would laugh at the line above. You see, and that's the reason I love him so little. And audiences would laugh, oh, you bastard. Now, I think most traditionally, and I'll even say it's probably a little something more like this. How shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus without advice begin to love her? That's a little more of a question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably the way it ought to be done, to be honest with you.
And what's the sense of that, that second reading?
One is, okay, how can I do it? How can I actually do it? I mean, what is the method in which I will do it? How shall I dote on her? Let me just figure this out. And the other one is more of, really? Can I do this? Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm being very clear. One is, how shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus without advice begin to love her? Let me figure this out. And the other is, how shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus without advice begin to love her? It's ridiculous. 'Tis but her picture I have yet beheld. Do you know what I mean?
And that goes to the questioning, and he doesn't really figure it
out.
Yeah,
and that's why I kind of did that perhaps weird-sounding version, because it seems like this is ridiculous. How could anyone do this? I just met her. 'Tis but her picture I have yet beheld, and that hath dazzled my reason's light.
Dazzled.
Touche.
What does Shakespeare intend, or what does Proteus mean by advice? It's used twice in these two lines.
It is.
What's the sense of that?
I think it's, how shall I dote on her with more advice, with more?
I want to say without more reason.
Without more reason? Yeah. I'm doing these weird things with my hands, but I'm trying to.
It's like a little grapefruit seed that you can't quite squeeze.
Maybe we'll have a helpful listener who can offer an interpretation of this.
Please.
A paraphrase.
We need an Oxford English dictionary.
How shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus, without advice, begin to love her?
I think the first advice is about, with more, I keep doing this pointing thing with my fingers, that with more intention, with more deliberation. And the second advice being without guidance, without...
Yeah, I think, I think what it is, if you work backwards, thus without advice began to love her, so without advice meaning that he hasn't spoken to her, he's just really seen her.
Sure.
He knows that it's problematic because his best friend's madly in love with her. Mm-hmm. He knows that he's betrothed to another woman. So without advice is like he's doing all these things. Like if he was to be given advice by a sane human being, they'd say run the other way. And then this is why I say it's reason. So I think he's saying in the first line, which is how can I continue forward like this in a reasonable way? Like how can I convince myself to continue forward like this, even though it began in such a senseless and ridiculous way.
Certainly, yeah. I think you're right. I think that's probably the simplest.
I don't know. I have a different interpretation that pops to mind. But
what do you think?
Well, what I think doesn't really matter.
No, it does. I think it does. Yeah.
I think that the reason that he has for loving Sylvia is so scant. It's just the advice of Valentine. Valentine bragged about Sylvia, and on the basis of this advice and the picture that he's seen, he, Proteus, has already begun to dote on her. Mm-hmm. How much more shall he dote on her than Valentine, who has the evidence of her beauty in front of him, when he ultimately does have that evidence? Who knows?
well, here's why I wanted you to say that, because going back to choices, and this is what...
No. Here's what I'm trying
Let's
to say.
Like scholars. So this is kind of like a discussion you might have with your director. Like, what does this mean? And sort of parsing it out, or with yourself. And eventually, you're going to have to make a choice one way or another about what it means, so that you in your head can be clear about what's going on, so that you can convey that thought to the audience as best as possible. So how do you go about...
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's that posing the laughable question to the audience was useful for me. To come to, how shall I dote on her with more advice, that thus, without advice, begin to love her?
Boy, these are hard.
Yeah.
But okay, anyway, so to move forward,
on,
yeah,
or
to
move back.
Well, to move forward, one of the things is that we talked about punctuation earlier, and the way you just performed it in our edition, there's an exclamation point, meaning the end of a sentence after love her. And you made the thought go from line 203 all the way through 206. So that you connected all of those things, which is a great example of what you were talking about, which is you go for the verse line or the thought.
Yeah, I feel like that's the one thing we know. We know the verse lines, 99% of them. And the punctuation is always just a little iffy, depending on the edition, if you're looking at the folio, blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely. As I'm hearing Jim describe this, I realize that we're going off of two different versions of the text. I'm taking the punctuation from the folio here, and I have a question mark.
Oh, there's the question mark in the folio?
It speaks directly to your point.
Oh, the it comes after, where's the question mark?
After love her.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. That is interesting.
Interesting.
Just to put a cap on this notion of these puzzles, these rhetorical puzzles that Shakespeare delights us with.
Yeah.
They're wonderful to encounter in a play.
Yeah.
And as an audience member, I find that when one strikes me, I will be puzzling it out in my head. And then I'll miss the next 2 minutes of what's going on.
That's it, man. You hit it on the head. That it's always a bad sign, I think, when you leave a scene or an act or even often a play when you say, what was the one part he was really angry? You know what I mean? Where you get the quality of the emotion kind of splashed on the surface, but you don't know what was really said. Man, what a juicy challenge to dig into these speeches on a nightly basis. And as we heard here, just three different points of view about one line is terrific.
But it does offer some justification for why it's important for actors to really dig in and make sense of it. Because if they don't make sense of it for the audience is required to make sense of it for themselves.
Yeah.
The audience is going to miss what comes next.
It is a challenge. It is a challenge line by line and night by night, definitely. But what a fun way to make a living.
My goodness.
You know?
Terrific. We're talking with Jeffrey Hawkins about Two Gentlemen of Verona, Act 2, Scene 4, and I have another line question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you mentioned that at the end of line 201, oh, but I love this lady, his lady, too much. You always got to laugh.
Yeah.
And the line itself sticks out to me like a sore thumb in the speech.
Sure. I mean, typically the laugh would come right after that. Oh, but I love his lady too much, and that's the reason I love him so little. That line is interesting, and I've certainly heard that different ways as well. I think my take on it was maybe the simpler version, that he's just searching for the words a little bit, that, oh, but I love his lady too much. But I've also heard, oh, but I love his lady too much. I love his lady also too much, which is a little interesting to me. I'm not sure that's the one for me. And I think what really attracts me to the way that I was doing it is just it sounded contemporary. And not that I always like those things. I frequently don't. But there's something kind of comfy and nice to get a moment like that in a Shakespeare play. This one, one could argue, is Shakespeare having a real kind of human moment.
Hmm.
Oh, but I love his lady too much. It's kind of nice to hear.
It's great for the audience. Shakespeare's written this, there are one syllable words except for lady.
Yeah.
The audience has a moment here to catch up.
Sure.
And to delight in the fact that the plot is shifting now.
Sure, yeah.
Now things are changing.
That's nice.
Oh, what's going to happen now? Proteus is in love with Sylvia. Nothing good can come of this.
Yeah.
And no matter what has preceded this, if the audience gets that line,
yeah,
they're on board.
That's very.
They know where we're going.
That's a keen observation. I like that. And I like those monosyllabic lines. Mm. And we got another one down there with shall be blind. And I really like taking my time with that, just letting that kind of sink in. Those are tasty, man. I like those.
And one last thing about 201, it starts with a dreaded O.
Yes, yes.
Oh, it does.
Yes, it does.
And so many actors are afraid of.
They are. People can be afraid of that. They turn into Urgh. They're afraid of the big O. But those are tasty, man. And I think those are fun for the audience, too, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Jeffrey Hawkins, thank you so much for joining us today on The State of Shakespeare.
Man, thank you, guys. I'm a fan. I'll be listening from now on.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
And thank you for listening. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And this was The State of Shakespeare. Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.